Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. I hope you've had a great week so far. It's National Nutrition Month, and on this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into how to eat for both health and performance. Over the years, we've discussed general recommendations and ideas about how to eat a health-promoting dietary pattern, but I wanted to go a bit further and create an actionable set of nutrition guidelines for you guys to take home and, you know, do them. It's no secret that the types and amount of food that we eat have a substantial impact on health and performance. While there's a lot of nutrition information available, much of it is confusing and, in many cases, not well supported by scientific evidence. Fortunately, there's a lot of overlap between a diet that is health-promoting and one that also supports high levels of physical performance. In this podcast, we'll cover the ins and outs of how to eat a diet that does both. To start, what is a healthy diet? Now, the aim of a healthy diet across the lifespan is to promote normal growth and development, to improve and maintain robust health and function throughout adulthood, and to prevent or delay the development of disease. We'll use the term dietary pattern to describe the habitual average dietary intake over long periods of time. The 2020 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee defines a dietary pattern as the quantities, proportions, variety, or combination of different foods, drinks, and nutrients in diets and the frequency with which they are habitually consumed. Rather than focusing on single foods or nutrients that a person might eat occasionally, the dietary pattern describes what they eat on average, or most of the time. This can be beneficial for research aiming to identify whether repeatedly eating a particular way correlates with disease. For example, eating a dietary pattern that's high in fiber and low in added sugars lowers the risk of heart disease and developing type 2 diabetes. Now, this long-term average intake is the main determinant of both the health and performance effects of a given diet. Changing people's dietary pattern is so important that improving dietary patterns across the population is one of the major public health goals. In fact, the 2020 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee suggests that a healthy diet features a high intake of vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, low or non-fat dairy, lean meat and poultry, seafood, nuts, and unsaturated fats, and a relatively lower intake of processed meats, food, and drinks with added sugars and refined grains. That's the dietary pattern that they're advertising, so to speak, but you know, these recommendations in principle are pretty good, but they don't provide enough specific guidance on what foods to eat and how much of them. In the rest of this podcast, we'll cover the details of the most important parts of the dietary pattern that supports both health and performance. We'll first start with calorie intake. Now, total daily calorie or energy intake should achieve a healthy body fat and muscle mass levels while also supporting appropriate amounts of physical activity. It is important to note that the regulation of calorie intake is a complex process that is not primarily under conscious control. In other words, you don't really decide to be hungry. Instead, the feeling of hunger seems to arise on its own until it demands our attention. How strongly this is felt and how it influences our behaviors involves a variety of biological, psychological, social, and environmental factors. And this can result in an appetite that is either matched or mismatched to our actual calorie needs, regardless of our conscious desires. The dietary pattern can play a strong role in how many calories we eat. For example, a diet that contains a lot of ultra-processed foods can lead to spontaneous increase in calories being consumed. Specifically, when we talk about ultra-processed foods, the definition is not well established and there's no real consensus here, but we're talking about foods that have added sodium, added sugars, and/or added fats, and these foods tend to be very tasty, high in calories, and not very filling. That's what we're talking about when we say ultra-processed foods. While acknowledging that there are ultra-processed foods from a technical perspective that can be health-promoting, like whey protein, for example. In contrast, plant-based dietary patterns, such as vegan and vegetarian diets, tend to reduce calorie intake considerably, with some studies suggesting over 600 fewer calories per day with a vegan diet. While we aren't specifically recommending a vegetarian or vegan diet to everyone, we do think that including more fruits, vegetables, and other plant matter is a good idea in general. Another factor that strongly influences calorie intake is the food environment. This refers to the foods available in a person's home, at work, and in their community at large. In general, the more access someone has to foods that are high in calories and aren't very filling, the higher their calorie intake is. And this seems to be true even when there are a lot of healthy options available in the same place, because the tasty, ultra-processed foods tend to win out despite our best efforts and intentions. In sum, a dietary pattern that supports both health and performance should result in the appropriate energy intake by consisting mostly of unprocessed or minimally processed foods. To figure out the amount of calories that you need, we recommend using the NIH Bodyweight Planner, which is a free tool based on some pretty good evidence. I've linked that in the description below. Again, you don't need to know your calorie total or target in order to eat a health-promoting dietary pattern or even to eat the appropriate energy balance. Again, this happens sort of spontaneously. It's not really under conscious control, but if you wanted to figure out how many calories you should be targeting, that's a good resource. Further, to adhere to this calorie level, we recommend modifying the food environment to increase access to these unprocessed or minimally processed foods and reduce access to those foods that have added sugar, added sodium, added fat, those ultra-processed foods that are very high in calories and tend to not be very filling. Now, we acknowledge that for the most part, an individual's intake is not under their conscious control, thereby signifying the importance of eating behavior determinants such as the food environment. In short, if the food environment doesn't or can't change, many will have a difficult time significantly changing their dietary pattern. Okay, next, let's talk about macronutrients. Now, macronutrients are the food-based compounds that humans eat in the biggest quantities. These include protein, carbohydrates, fat, and alcohol. The average amount of energy or calories in each macronutrient are approximately as follows. For 1 gram of protein, that's worth about 4 calories. For 1 gram of carbohydrates, that's about 4 calories as well. 1 gram of fat, 9 calories. And 1 gram of alcohol is about 7 calories. Based on data collected during interviews with tens of thousands of adults in the United States over recent decades, the average daily macronutrient intake is about 81 grams of protein, or 16.5% of the daily calorie intake. Carbohydrates represented 252 grams on average per day, or about half of the daily calorie intake, and fats, the intake was about 74 grams per day, or about 33% of the daily calorie intake. Now, the specific macronutrient composition of a diet, such as higher carb, lower fat, or higher fat, lower carb, has less significance for determining body weight or body weight trajectory compared to overall calorie intake, specifically energy balance. In other words, this calorie intake or the energy balance predicts weight change more than macronutrient proportions. An energy surplus is likely to drive an increase in weight, whereas an energy deficit is likely to reduce weight regardless of the macronutrient levels. And again, there's going to be inter-individual variation in how people respond to an energy surplus or energy deficit. Some people will lose weight readily in an energy deficit. Other people will lose weight a little more slowly. The magnitude of change is highly variable as well. And some interesting twin studies have shown, you know, up to a 7 times differential in response to the same amount of energy deficit between groups of twins, just meaning that people lose different amounts of weight in response to the same energy deficit. You may be familiar with the Twinkie diet, where Mark Haub, a professor of human nutrition at Kansas State University, ate nothing but Twinkies for 10 weeks, but at about an 800 calorie per day deficit from what he otherwise would need to maintain his weight. Over the 10-week experiment, he lost 27 pounds. He decreased his LDL by 20%. His triglycerides went down by about 40%, and he raised his HDL by 20%. All of this in response to an energy deficit, not a particular macronutrient composition. However, the composition of the diet can play a role in other ways. Diets have different impacts on feelings of fullness, which is known as satiety, a person's ability to stick to the diet, known as adherence, physical performance, body composition, so fat mass versus muscle mass, and other health effects. For example, increasing average dietary protein intake to about 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, which is about 112 grams of protein per day for a 70 kilo or 154 pound person. If you increase your protein to that from a lower level of habitual intake, that tends to increase strength and muscle growth from exercise, despite being the same energy balance, you just changed where the energy was coming from. Similarly, reducing intake of foods with added sugar can aid weight loss efforts by reducing total calorie intake due to increased feelings of fullness and reduced hunger. Now, in that case, switching the macronutrient sort of proportion actually changes the ability to adhere to a particular dietary pattern, particular energy balance, and again, helps with weight loss. Now, with respect to protein intake, we recommend most folks should typically get around 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, unless there is a specific medical reason to consume less. People who are actively losing weight and or who have risk factors for anabolic resistance, such as a chronic disease requiring the use of glucocorticoids, well, they may aim a bit higher. Highly competitive physique athletes, such as bodybuilders who are attempting to maintain as much muscle mass as possible while dieting and who are already relatively lean, may benefit from increasing their intake to as high as, 3 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. But overall, for those who are able to consume protein within this range, about 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day or more, the plant protein sources such as soy, lentils, etc. appear to be as equivalent to animal protein sources such as fish, eggs, chicken, beef, etc. for promoting muscle strength and muscle growth. However, the distinction between plant and animal protein sources may be more important for those eating a protein-restricted diet or those eating less than the current RDA, which is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day. Basically, the further you get away from our sort of recommended minimum protein intake, the more the protein quality starts to matter. In this case, prioritizing animal-derived protein sources may lead to better outcomes with respect to strength and muscle growth. It's also worth noting that there may still be other health benefits to plant-derived proteins, including those in higher quantities, apart from muscle-related effects, because in general, eating more plant-based foods tends to result in a healthier dietary pattern. Achieving this minimal level of protein in the diet isn't actually a huge stretch, as the average protein intake in the United States is about 1 gram per kilogram body weight per day. Unfortunately, the majority of this tends to come from ultra-processed foods and protein sources that contain a lot of fat, thereby increasing overall energy intake. To summarize, we recommend that most people consume a minimum of 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of total body weight per day, and that that protein comes predominantly from lean, unprocessed, minimally processed sources, or even plant sources. We need to take a quick break for our sponsors, but when we come back, we'll talk about carbohydrates, fats, and more. This podcast is brought to you by Pioneer Belts. At Pioneer Belts, they have belts for all applications. If you're interested on how belts work or how to choose a belt, check out our podcast episode number 219. Most people will do best with a 4-inch wide belt that's 10 millimeters thick, either single prong or lever, depending on the fastening mechanism that you prefer. Pioneer has industry-exclusive micro-adjustments on their lever belts for ease of use without tools. They also make custom belts to your specs, depending on what you want. Trusted by some of the world's strongest athletes, choose Pioneer for your weightlifting belts and accessories. Head to generalleathercraft.com and tell them Barbell Medicine sent you. All right, welcome back to the Barbell Medicine podcast. We're talking about how to eat for health and performance. All right, on to carbohydrates. For most individuals, carbohydrates represent nearly half of the calories consumed daily, and carbohydrate intake therefore represents a large, modifiable component of overall energy balance. Now, the specific amount of daily carbohydrate intake does not carry a ton of significance, provided that other components of a health-promoting dietary pattern are in place, although the types of carbohydrates can have significant health and performance implications. For example, multiple lines of converging data show that diets higher in fiber correlate with better health, likely due to the consumption of a dietary pattern that's rich in foods that are naturally high in fiber, like fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains. And if you're eating those things, you're not eating other things that wouldn't be as health-promoting. While fiber in and of itself may not be entirely causal, the data suggests that the total dietary fiber intake should be at least 25 to 30 grams per day. And again, ideally, these come from vegetables, fruits, and complex carbohydrate sources like whole grains, legumes, and so on. One quick note. Recent evidence has suggested that low levels of dietary carbohydrate may impair muscle mass gain along with strength and endurance performance, particularly in trained individuals. Based on the existing evidence, we do not recommend a very low carbohydrate diet for trained individuals whose goals include significant muscular hypertrophy or strength, though a low carbohydrate diet may be a reasonable choice for individuals who are new to exercise who are trying to lose weight. There's likely minimal risk of impairing muscle gain in these individuals, particularly when compared with the substantial benefits of reducing fat mass and improving dietary patterns. In short, if you want to be keto or low carb and you're new to training, that's probably fine. If you're looking to maximize performance, those are probably not the dietary patterns that we would recommend. And in summary, we recommend eating as many servings of carbohydrates as is consistent with the total calorie goal and the preferred dietary pattern. For performance-minded folks, we recommend a minimum of about 3 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram body weight per day. And again, these carbohydrates should primarily come from fiber-containing foods like whole grains, legumes, fruits, and vegetables. Finally, we recommend limiting access to foods with added sugar, particularly sugar-sweetened beverages like sodas and teas. It seems like these beverages that contain added sugars, we do not compensate for them later on in the day by eating less. We eat the same amount we would otherwise eat, but instead, we've also had these calories from that liquid beverage. Okay, next, let's talk about fat intake. Now, fats are the second major energy source for most humans, representing about a third of total daily energy intake on average. Food sources rich in fats include oils, butter, certain animal meats, fish, dairy products, eggs, nuts, and avocados, among others. Now, like carbohydrates, the specific amount of daily intake does not carry a ton of significance, provided that other components of a health-promoting dietary pattern are in place, although the types of fats can have significant impacts on health and performance. For example, foods consisting mostly of unsaturated fats, those coming from marine or plant sources, tend to be more health-promoting than those rich in saturated fat, particularly those from red meat consumed at relatively high levels. Additionally, many ultra-processed foods that are high in calories but aren't particularly filling contain added fats. We would recommend reducing access to these as a method of modifying the food environment. Essential fatty acids, like essential amino acids, cannot be produced by the body and therefore must be included in the diet. These include linoleic acid, that's an omega-6 fat, and alpha-linolenic acid, ALA, that's an omega-3 fat. Well, deficiencies in total fatty acid intake are associated with a wide range of diseases, including skin disorders, hair loss or depigmentation, and poor wound healing in adults due to the decreased intake of fat-soluble vitamins, that's vitamins A, D, E, and K, and also essential fatty acid-driven cellular functions. In children, essential fatty acid deficiency can lead to reduced growth and increased susceptibility to infections. Fortunately, essential fatty acid deficiency is very rare outside of serious medical conditions where fat intake, digestion, absorption, and/or metabolism are severely impaired. Conditions associated with malabsorption increase the risk of essential fatty acid deficiency. Such conditions include things like Crohn's disease, cystic fibrosis, and individuals who have undergone surgical removal or otherwise instrumentation of significant portions of their intestines, among others. While there are other potential causes of essential fatty acid deficiency, deliberate dietary restriction is a very rare cause. So in summary, we recommend eating as many servings of fat as is consistent with the total calorie intake that you need and your preferred dietary pattern. Similar to the carbohydrate intake, if you prefer a lower carb approach, well, you're going to eat more dietary fat. If you prefer a higher carb approach, you're going to consume less dietary fat to overall be consistent with your calorie goals. Now, fats should be primarily unsaturated, so coming from seafood and plant sources, with saturated fat limited to approximately 10% or less of total calories. Now, there is some nuance there with respect to saturated fat coming from dairy sources. And if you really wanted to micromanage this, I wouldn't really worry about saturated fat coming from dairy sources. I'd be most concerned about this coming from things like butter, things like red meat, and so on. And on average, most people do not consume a ton of saturated fat, far above that 10% of total daily calories sort of limit we talked about. But those using some more interesting dietary patterns, carnivore comes to mind, some versions of ketogenic diets come to mind. It is possible. And so for those folks, we feel a little bit more strongly about kind of regulating that saturated fat intake. Finally, we recommend limiting access to ultra-processed foods with added fats, particularly those that also contain added sugar and sodium. That is a recurring theme of this podcast and dietary recommendations in general. If you limit access to these types of foods, you're less likely to eat them. If you keep them in the home, it's going to be very difficult to avoid eating them, and they do tend to predict people eating far more calories than if they weren't available and if they weren't in the dietary pattern. Okay, now let's talk about supplements. Full disclosure, we do own a supplement business. And if you wanted to know what supplements do we recommend, well, those are the ones that we sell. Not too many. If you go to our product page, you're going to see that there's not a ton of supplements on the page. And that is distinctly different from other manufacturers, but that is by design. Now, with respect to supplements, they're obviously very common. 75% of Americans report taking dietary supplements in the previous year, and that contributes to the over $35 billion a year supplement market in the United States alone. Unfortunately, there's a lot of conflicting information out there about what supplements are useful or even safe. And while we don't think that most people need to take a supplement to live a full and complete life, we acknowledge that there are some supplements with evidence for improving mostly performance, less about health. Let's briefly cover some information regarding supplement safety as well as what evidence-based supplementation would look like. Now, in the United States, dietary supplements are classified as food and are therefore not subject to pre-market testing by the FDA. In contrast, pharmaceutical drugs are subject to pre-market testing. Now, the FDA tried to help by establishing good manufacturing practices, GMP, and this is in an effort to limit supplement contamination, enforce accurate labeling, and set standards for monitoring and reporting adverse events. Unfortunately, over one quarter of supplement companies are not registered with the FDA, and of those who are registered, about 70% are in violation of GMP standards. Overall, about 20% of all dietary supplements available for purchase are likely contaminated, and 30 to 50% of all supplements are incorrectly labeled. These are both likely underestimations due to underreporting and lack of research. Also, there's going to be a different sort of spread amongst different categories of supplements. Supplements aimed at muscle gain or sexual performance or fat loss, those tend to be the most commonly adulterated and mislabeled sort of supplements out there, you know, whereas vitamin C is probably a little bit different. Safety concerns aside, however, many supplements don't contain ingredients with good supporting evidence for benefit in the first place. And even if they do, the ingredients are often not present in the right amounts. Now, at the beginning of this, I said that most of the supplements that we would talk about, and certainly the supplements that we actually market and recommend, are for performance, not for health. But for health, a bunch of supplements get a ton of airplay, but they don't actually have good evidence showing a benefit. For example, supplementing with vitamin D, fish oil, or multivitamins don't seem to be beneficial for most people at reducing the risk of things like heart disease, certain types of cancer, or really any other medical condition outside of those with very specific sort of medical issues that require supplementation. Fortunately, that's not most people. We have podcasts on all three of these supplements if you'd like a deeper dive into them, and I've linked them in the description below. Now, a protein supplement may actually be beneficial for both health and performance for those who would otherwise not consume the recommended amount of protein. A small other set of supplements have research showing benefit for performance, and these are found in our PeriRx supplement if that is consistent with someone's goals. I'm not going to go through each one of the ingredients in PeriRx. You can check that out. It's linked in the description below, and those are the amounts that we would recommend if you were asking us what supplements should I take to improve performance. Overall, we recommend considering the potential risks and benefits of each supplement based on evidence in humans and determining whether or not it's a good fit for you. If you decide to use supplements, we recommend obtaining them from manufacturers that are GMP certified and third-party tested by informed consent, USP, NSF, or a similar reputable organization. Those should all be clearly labeled on the actual label of the supplement. Finally, a word on fad diets. Now, there are lots of confident claims about very specific diets being, quote, optimal for health and or performance. These seem to span the full range of possibilities from vegan to carnivore, low carbohydrate to high carbohydrate, low fat to high fat, low protein to high protein, fruitarian, paleo, keto, and many more. However, there's really no good scientific evidence showing clear superiority of any particular diet for health and performance. And put very simply, the best diet is the one that you can stick to. Instead, we can find good health outcomes across a wide variety of populations and habitual dietary intakes. Examining the eating patterns of these populations often reveals a few common features among them, which we've discussed in this podcast so far. In contrast, other dietary features are clearly and consistently associated with higher risks of disease and premature death. For example, consuming a diet that is high in fiber has consistently been shown to be beneficial for health, whereas a diet that contains a lot of foods with added sugars has consistently been shown to be deleterious to health. So while nutrition science is extremely complex, imperfect, and in some situations controversial, we already know more than enough to improve health and performance through nutrition. The list of targets discussed in this podcast outline a dietary pattern that supports both health and performance. Although this information may be helpful from a knowledge perspective, actually changing dietary behavior can be extremely difficult and complex. This is because eating behavior is influenced by a variety of, again, biological, psychological, social, and environmental factors, and much of this regulation of appetite and food-related behavior occurs outside of our conscious control. So while we think that the information presented here is useful, we want listeners to understand that general human eating behavior emerges from the interactions between an individual's genetic predispositions, subconscious regulation processes, and aspects of the surrounding environment like access to food, social context, and many others. Knowing these factors, we focus heavily on behavior change in our coaching rather than just giving people information and expecting immediate change. Finally, while we think that everyone could benefit from a dietary pattern that promotes health and performance, it is important to avoid focusing exclusively on body weight or body composition as a reflection of health. People have different values, different preferences, and different goals, and we should respect those when treating individuals. There are often a number of lifestyle changes that can offer benefits independent of any effect on body weight or body fat. We recommend a dietary pattern that meets the targets covered in this podcast thus far, and there are many ways to do so. Further, we recommend focusing on the foods consumed most frequently and an individual's food environment rather than focusing on single nutrients or a very specific type of diet, even if it is popular. To summarize, total daily calorie or energy intake should achieve healthy body fat levels and muscle mass while also supporting appropriate amounts of physical activity. Use the NIH body weight planner that's linked in the description below if you would find a calorie target helpful. We also recommend changing the food environment to reduce access to foods with added sugar, added sodium, and increase the availability of minimally processed foods in the home and or workplace to the extent that's possible. We recommend that most people consume about 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, coming primarily from lean, predominantly unprocessed or minimally processed sources. We recommend about 3 grams of carbohydrates per kilogram body weight per day from primarily fiber-containing foods like whole grains, legumes, fruits, and vegetables. We recommend limiting access to foods with added sugar, particularly sugar-sweetened beverages like sodas and teas. Fats should be primarily unsaturated, so from seafood and plant sources, with saturated fat limited to approximately 10% or less of total calories. When replacing saturated fat with other nutrients, we recommend foods rich in unsaturated fats or complex carbohydrates, depending on an individual's preferences. We recommend considering the potential risks and benefits of supplements based on evidence in humans and determining whether or not it's a good fit for you. And if you decide to use supplements, we recommend obtaining them from manufacturers that are GMP certified and third-party tested by informed consent, USP, NSF, or a similar reputable organization. All right, that's it for this episode of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend and leave us a 5-star review. Have a great day.